Republic City Tribune Tower, Tribune Square. For just a second, Luo Qiang thought he'd dozed off in his office and was having that dream again. The one where the Wong girl was yelling his name. She was an irritating little creature in person, all full of airs and ideas that she was going to be a real reporter someday, and she had zero tolerance for old-fashioned newsroom paternalism. But in certain of Luo's dreams, she tended to be much more amenable to the traditional role of a junior reporter. Then he realized that he was not, in fact, asleep at his desk, and furthermore that Wong's voice seemed to be coming from behind him. Which was a bit puzzling, since the only thing behind him was his office window, and his office was on the 21st floor. He swiveled in his chair, and then stared in amazement at the sight of Emily Wong, standing with a face like thunder about 10 feet from the window, as though the office were at street level, and she stood on the sidewalk. Startled, he bolted from his chair and threw open the window. Leaning out, he saw that Emily had not, in fact, somehow learned how to fly, but, very nearly as astonishingly, was standing on the back of an Air Nomad Sky Bison, whose master was keeping it in a very steady hover just below the window. "Wong, what in the world?" he began, but Emily cut him off. Fists clenched and arms akimbo, face nearly crimson with rage, she bellowed in a voice that could be heard plainly out in the bullpen. "You imbecile! What in the world possessed you to libel the Avatar in an article with my name on it?" For a moment, Luo was so taken aback he couldn't even react. Then, with the fury of his own rising, he leaned out the window and shouted back, "Who the hell do you think you are, Wong? I haven't seen your cute little butt in the bullpen all day, and then you show up taking that tone with me?" Drawing himself up in a slightly futile effort to assert his authority over someone who was shouting at him from the sky outside his window, he added lamely, "You're lucky I don't fire you." Emily snorted, sneering at him, all the disdain and resentment she felt at having spent 2 years as this patronizing creature's lackey boiling up at once. "You can't fire me," she shot back. "You don't have the balls to fire me. I'm the only thing standing between you and the entire White Lotus legal team, you pusillanimous sack of talentless mung." Pointing toward his chair with an imperious finger, she went on, "Now you sit there and you think about what you did. I'll be back to clean up your mess when I'm friggin' good and ready. And if you know what's good for you, you'll stay out of my way while I'm doing it." Then, turning away, she sat down behind the low wall at the front of the bison's saddle and gave it a couple of thumps with her hand. Not very convincingly hiding a smile under an impassive front, the skinny Air Nomad youth at the controls twitched the reins and guided the animal away from the building. As soon as they were a reasonable distance from the Tribune building, which didn't take long at Vayu's cruising speed, Nima glanced back over her shoulder with a grin and said, "That was nicely done." "I feel so much better," said Emily, sagging wearily against the prow of Vayu's saddle. "Okay, now I can sleep." She told Nima her address, but by the time they arrived, she was already out like a light. She would always wonder thereafter how the spindly young Air Nomad had gotten her up to her fourth-floor walk-up apartment and into her bed. Air Temple Island. "Well, that must have gone well," Minami Sato announced, striding into the sun parlor once the reporter had left the house. "Yeah, the walls are still vertical, and I didn't see Miss Wong launched into the harbor," Ryo added, carrying a small basket with him as he followed his sister in. "I still remember that one time when we were at that joint meeting," he continued, looking over at Cora. Cora, for her part, hadn't reacted to the sibling's words. She was standing by one of the open, east-facing windows, watching the buff-colored form of Vayu receding toward the city skyline as Nima ran Emily home. Once the bison was out of view, Cora's broad shoulders sagged, and she turned and flung herself back into the chair she had been occupying with a great sigh. Four things never change. Death, taxes, the spirits, and the rumor mill. Cora grumbled as she looked up at the ceiling, not addressing anybody in particular. There were murmurs of agreement from those assembled, especially from Rio and Minami. Since Kate had taken the chair Emily had vacated, the Satos found the chairs full and the futon daybed arguably overfull, since it had Annabelle, all three of her parents, and her dragon on it. So they seated themselves at opposite ends of the sofa which stood along the wall. Still, it could have been worse. Much worse. Cora let out a self-deprecating chuckle as she lowered her gaze from the ceiling to her friends. The media's come up with some whoppers, particularly back in the day.
Oh? Do tell, Kate said with her impish smile.
Cora rolled her eyes in a sidelong glance at the samurai.
Well, since you asked so nicely.
She reached back with her arms, hands interlaced, stretching her body briefly before settling back down into a more relaxed slouch.
As you can imagine, with a job like mine, in the public eye all the time, there have been all sorts of contradictory theories as to who I was with at any given time, even if the actual concrete evidence was right there in front of them. Right from the start of my public career, I mean, you take my original team, Mako, Bolin, Asami, any of them at any one time, or all three of them at once, which, if nothing else, I have to take as a vote of confidence in my stamina. Oh, don't give me that shocked look, Minami. I might be a girl, but your great-great-grandmother was very attractive. I had quite a bit of adjustment getting used to that, let me tell you, she added, reddening slightly with a smile. Nothing in my woefully limited experience of the world up to then had prepared me for Asami Sato blowing into my life. She grinned at Minami's blushing, startled look and Ryo's brief, dumbfounded expression. Hey, Asami had no shortage of suitors. You have to accept that, at least. Do I have to explain the sparrowkeets and the bumbleflies to you again?
Rio shook his head.
No, no, we're good.
Cora chuckled.
Good. Anyway, that was just the tip of the iceberg. Pretty much anybody I've spent any significant time with, in some fashion, I've been paired with romantically in the press. Even some of my enemies, weirdly enough. Opponents in the pro-bending ring, various people I've butted heads with out in the field. I never understood that. I mean, come on, Tano? I had to touch that guy to give him his bending back, and afterwards I just wanted to go and wash my hands for an hour.
She looked around at a small sea of puzzled faces.
You have no idea what I'm talking about now. Okay, moving on. It was mostly my friends, anyway. Bending teammates, colleagues from Project Phoenix Flight or the White Lotus. Even Aang didn't have to put up with so much commentary on his social life.
She sighed and made a what-can-you-do-with-this gesture.
And that was just the fanzines and stuff like Section 4. It only got worse when TV and computers started really taking off. That was about when the White Lotus finally got their act together and made a media division to handle all of it.
So that's why Chiang's a Master Lotus, Caitlin mused.
Well, yeah. He's not my first press agent. That position's been around for nearly a century now. They certainly managed to reduce the number of embarrassing pictures I was in. Spirits, that one of me and President Raiko back in 171.
Cora shook her head at an awkward memory.
It can't have been easy for them. Especially once you got to the ubiquitous electronic media stage, Utrina commented. harder to get people to throttle back by talking with them, like we just managed to do with Emily there. Oh yeah, Cora nodded. For instance, back in 193, that's what? 2312 to you. Agni, almost 100 years ago, she said, pausing for a second to fathom that. Then, shaking herself slightly, she went on, I backseated for Asami in the Future City Historic GP, the first one. And for weeks afterwards, this one guy on the Avatar Spotters BBS, no lightning web yet, remember, was obsessed with the crypto-lesbian subtext. With a faint smirk, she added, Guy was really reading into the Winner's Circle champagne thing, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah, I've seen the pictures at the Sato Museum, Corwin commented, waggling his eyebrows suggestively. Cora rolled her eyes and gently punched his shoulder, unable to entirely suppress a smile. Pervert. Cora shrugged. You guys looked awesome together, he said mildly. I don't see how digging that is perverted. Minami opened her mouth, trying to think of something to say. That's... Well, Ryo finished for her, equally at a loss for words. Cora nodded sagely to the Satos. People will think the craziest things, I know. I've just had to get used to it. Ah, you know what it's like, right? We do indeed, answered the voice of Master Rohan, standing at the doorway. Behind him could be seen Milo, with two lemurs on his shoulders. Good afternoon, everyone. Lady Anthe, I do hope the discussion with Miss Wong did not upset little Annabelle. Oh no, not at all, replied Anthe with a smile. She seemed to be quite taken with her. Nobody cares if I was upset. Oh no, Garnet mumbled. My apologies, Mistress Garnet, Rohan replied, making the airbender salute toward the dragonette. I did not wish to distract you from your duties. Mollified, Garnet nestled back against Annabelle's shoulder. Fine. Just see that it doesn't happen again. Rohan nodded graciously. Of course not, my lady. My lady. I like that. Can we keep him? The dragon murmured to Anthe, drawing a chuckle from her and Utrina. I don't know. I'm pretty sure he's already taken, Utrina commented with a thoughtful look toward the airbending master. That would be a correct assumption, Prince Utrina, Rohan replied, unperturbed. But I'll let my wife know that her good taste is appreciated. Speaking of which, I believe there's somebody else who would like to meet the newest member of the family. Isn't that right, Makoto? Milo announced as he moved his way past his younger brother. And a pleasant and delightful afternoon to you all as well. He continued as he made the airbender salute and bowed, allowing Makoto the lemur to take off from his perch and sail over to Anthea's shoulder. Meanwhile, the other lemur, a gray-furred, ring-tailed specimen, absently picked crumbs from Milo's beard. Thanks, Master Milo, Utrina replied as she watched Garnet and Makoto eyeing each other from their respective positions. It's definitely been different. Also, Cora, I couldn't help overhearing the subject of your discussion from earlier about your colleagues, Milo went on. What would my romantic chances be, perchance? Cora rolled her eyes with a put-upon expression. I changed your diapers, Milo. That's an automatic disqualification. Milo did not appear dismayed by this blatant dismissal. He just shrugged and replied with an amused smile, Oh well, maybe in another 20 years. In another 20 years, we'll be back where we started, Cora muttered, almost inaudibly. Spirits, I did not need that image, Minami said with an exaggerated twitch, which her brother mirrored. Rohan coughed and raised his voice. "Be that as it may," he said, trying to get the conversation back on track, "I have been in discussion with Jinora about your plan to establish a homestead within the borders of the United Republic, and I believe we have a potential solution for you." "Wait, you're planning on moving here?" Minami asked, her previous discomfiture forgotten. "Why didn't you tell us earlier?" "Not full-time, but yeah, we're looking into building a home in the Republic. We just figured it out ourselves this morning," Corman admitted. "And it might still be a little early to be using words as generous as plan." "Hell, son, if we'd known, we'd have gladly given you the back 40 on the ranch," Rio added. "It's got a lake, you know." Corwin laughed. "Thanks, Rio. I appreciate it, I really do. But I think we want something a little closer to Republic City. Anyway, we can dig into it more later on." He smiled, looking over at Anthy and Annabelle, who were watching the stare-off between Garnet and Makoto. Finally, the Dragonette apparently judged the lemur no threat and moved aside so that Makoto could approach his mistress's daughter. "All right, you can pass, but no funny business." "Garnet, it'll be all right, believe me," Anthy said with a smile. "Makoto, this is Annabelle." "Annabelle? Makoto." Lemur eyes met baby eyes for several moments, and then with a chitter, Makoto turned around and scampered over Utena's lap to reach the fruit bowl that had been placed on the end table there, retrieving one of the fruits within. He then darted back to his place next to Anthy and tried to offer the fruit to Annabelle. "Oh, that's very thoughtful of you, Makoto," Anthy said with a gently reproachful smile as she guided the lemur's paws away from her daughter's face. "But please don't take offense. Annabelle doesn't want that right now." The lemur let out a puzzled chirp, looking around in confusion. Corwin grinned and reached out his hand. "Hey, I do. Is that a lychee? All right," he said as he accepted the offered fruit and peeled it. Caitlin let out a thoughtful hum and looked over at the avatar. "Cora, do you still have those pictures? I'm curious." "What? Yeah, on my laptop, ironically enough," said Cora with a wink, thinking of Emily's recently declared distrust of digital photo archiving. "It's in my room. Let me go get it," she added, starting to get out of her chair. Milo stopped her with a raised hand. "Oh, no need to get up, my love. Let me handle it." With that, the aged master pulled out a small cylindrical whistle from beneath his robes and blew three sharp notes on it. Immediately, the lemur on his shoulder came to attention, and three other flying lemurs soared in from the open sunroom windows and perched on his other shoulder and his outstretched arms. "Good, good. Poki, Tosa, Ogo, Limu, if you would be so kind," he said, and then trailed off into a series of chittering, clicking chirps and whistles. The four lemurs appeared to take this on board, and as one they leapt off Milo's robes and soared back out the window, in such a hurry that they didn't even seem to notice there had been a tiger in the room the entire time. "Gonna be honest, that was a little disturbing," Rio stated. "It is not for nothing that Milo is called the Master of Lemurs," Rohan stated gravely. "Father always wondered what he had unleashed upon the world when he taught my brother how to train them." "Well, I think it's charming," Anthy replied. "Isn't that right, Makoto?" "Prrrt," replied the lemur. "She's got you there, Rohan," Cora remarked with a smile. Yes, Rohan muttered. "In any case, if you wish, I can take you and your family out to see the sight tomorrow, Corwin." "Sounds great," Corwin replied. "Let's all go." "Actually, I'm afraid I'll have to pass, Corwin. I need to meet with Eitaro tomorrow and let him know we're bringing Emily on board for the comet case," Cora explained. And I think Junichan and I will be spending most of our last day in town at the Zuko Academy, Caitlin added, so that she can show Master Ito and me just how much she's improved in, gosh, a little under a week? Time flies, doesn't it? Cora asked with a grin. Aw, said Corwin disappointedly. I'd love to go, but I'm afraid I just can't, Minami said ruefully. I'm already skiving off work today. Ryo can go, though, she added brightly. His office is just for show anyway. My loving sister, ladies and gentlemen, said Ryo cheerfully. But no, really, love to. I can help you size up the site. With a sarcastic look at Minami, he added, I do have a little experience in the building trades. Sure, glad to have the help. Corwin smiled at Anthe and their daughter. Annabelle's first big day out. Utrina chuckled slightly. Man, the poor kid's going to be all tired out, and she was just born less than 24 hours ago. Cora looked like she was about to say something, but at that moment the four winged lemurs returned through the open window, carrying a pillowcase with a blocky item slung within it, grasped by the open end in their lower paws. Ha! Not bad! Cora exclaimed, catching the bundle as the lemurs dropped the cloth-wrapped laptop in her hands. Good work, you four. Have some fruit, she said, gesturing toward the fruit bowl before she extracted her cabbage computer's laptop from within the pillowcase. The lemurs thought this a fine suggestion and scampered over to the fruit bowl, ignoring the protests from Garnet in the process. Once they ate their fill, they chittered and squeaked at Makoto as they exited out the window, all save the first ring-tailed lemur, who glided back to Milo's shoulder to resume his station. Very good, Pokey. Here, have another, Milo said as he produced a lychee from a pouch beneath his robes and offered it to the lemur. All right, Cora said as she pulled her armchair closer to the futon, setting the open laptop on the bedspread so that those assembled could get a better view. Gather round, kids, it's Avatar story time. They whiled away an hour or two riffling through Cora's enormous collection of photographs, which she had gathered together and electronically conserved in a mildly deranged fit of diligence one weekend not too long ago. She had evidently run out of steam before she got to the part where the pictures got curated in any but the most rudimentary sense, so what she had was basically the digital equivalent of a giant drawer full of photos, loosely stratified chronologically, but otherwise mostly unsorted. For their purposes today, though, that was good enough, and half the fun came in the thrill of random discovery. The eight, Annabelle, Serge, and Makoto weren't too interested, were just starting to think about adjourning for dinner when Maki and Izumi arrived, in civvies, bearing between them a large, bucket-shaped object. This proved, when set down and unpacked, to be a multi-leveled bamboo arrangement for carrying prepared food. Master Jinora's kitchen sends dinner for everyone, with her compliments, so that Lady Anthe need not be left alone for the afternoon meal, said Izumi with a smile as she started handing out plates. Ah, the famous Air Nomad hospitality, said Ryo happily, cracking a fresh pair of chopsticks. If you don't mind, we'll stay and eat with you, said Maki, only slightly hesitant about inviting herself. We're heading back to Kyoshi Island tonight, she explained, so this will be our last chance to see you for a while. With a wry grin for Corwin, she added, hopefully not quite as long a while this time. Bet on that, he said. By all means, join us, Anthe agreed. There are more chairs in the hall. Corwin, be a dear. They dined informally in this cheerful, sun-drenched setting, from collapsible tables or plates balanced on knees or just the free end of the futon, making pleasant conversation. Juniper arrived toward the end, virtually bouncing into the room to inform her sensei breathlessly that the afternoon's practice had gone very well indeed. The Pons checked in shortly thereafter, having been out who knew where, getting all windswept and picturesque.
"So, has anyone seen Null since this morning?"
Amy wondered.
"Nope, no sign of him," said Uchna.
"This is perhaps not that surprising," put in Corwin dryly, making her snicker.
"What did I miss?" Rio wondered.
He and Lakpa, sort of," said Corwin, trailing off with a vague, "you know the rest of this verse" gesture.
"Oh," said Rio, nodding thoughtfully. "She finally caught him, eh?" he added with a wry grin.
"Or he caught her," said Utena. "I'm trying not to look that closely." Rio nodded again, repeating,
"Oh."
"Well," said Minami pragmatically after a moment's thought, "I hope at least one of them has acquired some rudimentary capacity for discretion, or Jinora may become the first airbender in history to kill a dragon."
"Be nice, Min Min," Rio chided her.
At meal's end, the party dispersed. Anne excused herself first, remarking that she was beat after a day of throwing her chi at the wall. The phrase made Kate, Cora, and Corwin, all of whom had heard Azana say it, glance at each other with little smiles, and wanted her bed badly. She bade everyone a fond good night and took herself off to it. After packing up the dishes in the empty food carrier, Maki and Izumi semi-formally took their leave with bows and polite words, though Maki was hardly allowed to get away with that, and received a sound hug from both Corwin and Uchna before she left. Amy and Rory went along to see them off at the train station, and shortly thereafter the Satos prepared to depart as well, saying their goodbyes and nice meeting yous to Anthy, Annabelle, and Garnet. Corwin and Cora went with them back out to their autogyro and helped them get it untied and ready to go.
"I'll see you in the morning, son," said Rio, shaking Corwin's hand. "What time are you figuring on leaving? I'll see if I can't get out here by 9 or so."
"Why don't we just pick you up?" Corwin wondered. "I mean, it's Rohan's party. I assume we'll be going by Sky Bison, wherever we're headed. I'll call you when we leave."
Rio nodded.
"Okay, sounds good. We're still in the same place as before."
"Goodbye, Corwin," said Minami, hugging him warmly. "It's been wonderful to see you again, and I really enjoyed meeting your family. Your daughter's lovely."
She kissed him on the cheek and let him go, giving him a twinkling emerald wink.
"I was kidding before, but it does make a girl think," she added with a grin, then trailed her fingertips along the line of his bearded jaw as she turned away and headed for the aircraft. "Ready to go, Rio?"
Getting an affirmative thumbs up from the back, Minami climbed into the front cockpit, made certain the prop and rotors were clear, and fired up the autogyro, then spun the rotors up to full RPM, cut the power to the rotor head, gunned the main engine, and took off. The aircraft jumped into the air after only a short run across the grass by the Bagua Circle. Corwin and Cora stood together and waved until the autogyro was just a dot and a winking running light far out across the bay, then turned to each other.
"Well," said Cora, "I've got some stuff I have to do. Besides, you four deserve some alone together time. It's been a busy day."
So saying, she hugged him the way she had when he was a kid, picking his feet up off the ground, and when she put him down, he did the same in turn to her. Then she, too, kissed him on the cheek, murmuring, "Good night, Corwin."
"Night," he said, and she broke away and trotted off toward the ladies' quarters, giving him a wave back over one shoulder.
He watched her go, smiling to himself, and then turned and walked back to Tenzin's house. Evening was settling in,
The shadows beginning to lengthen at a touch of springtime chill to enter the air. But they stayed in the sun parlor all the same, to eke out every last drop of the beautiful day that they could. Having seen to Annabelle's frequent but not onerous needs while Corwin was parting from the Satos, Anthy was sitting up reading as Baby and Dragon dozed in her lap. When she'd returned to the futon after the operations, she'd settled nearer to the edge. Utna, in the middle, slid over a bit closer so that Corwin, in turn, would have room to lie beside her. While Anthy read, they quietly, contentedly cuddled next to her, discussing the day's events and how well the meeting with Emily had finally turned out. An hour or so later, Anthy reached the end of the hardback volume she was reading, closed it, and asked, "Corwin, dear, would you do me a favor?" "Sure," said Corwin. "What do you need?" "I've finished my book a bit sooner than I was expecting," she said, holding up that item. "Would you please take this one back to the Air Temple's library and bring me back the next volume?" she said, offering him the book. "I can do that," he said agreeably, rising. Walking around to her side of the futon, he bent and took the book. Glancing at the spine, he grinned. "Aha," he said. "Avatar Yangchen's memoirs. I think you would have gotten along with Yangchen." He bent further and gave her a kiss, then headed off down the hall and out of the house. Despite the Air Nomad's well-deserved reputation for being an orderly and scholarly people, the Air Temple's library was not very well curated, or at least Corwin had never thought so. If the way it was organized had some underlying logic, it had always eluded his own mind. It took him several minutes to find the rest of Yangchen's memoirs, and they weren't filed in what he would have thought of as order, either, so further hunting was required to find the volume he, or rather Anthy, actually wanted. He was still engaged in that task when he noticed, out of the corner of his eye, that one of the library's side doors was open. He turned to find Nima standing framed in the doorway, regarding him with a hard-to-read expression. When his eyes fell upon her, she blinked and reddened slightly, taking a half-step back as though she intended to retreat. "Oh, hey, Nima," said Corwin, preoccupied enough with his task not to notice the details. "What's up?"
Oh, nothing.
Nima began. But then, with a startled yelp, she suddenly lurched into the room, bounding over the threshold to keep from falling over it, as she was unexpectedly shoved from behind.
"Nima has something she wants to tell you, Corwin," said Lakva cheerfully from the hall.
Then she slid the door shut with a bang and could be heard trotting off down the hall, humming tunelessly. Nima stood a couple of feet inside the closed door, feet a little awkwardly placed where she'd had to put them for balance, her face crimson and gray eyes wide with horror. She looked back over her shoulder, saw that the door was closed, and seemed to be weighing the possibility of just crashing through it to escape, then turned back to Corwin with a look of helpless dismay. For his part, Corwin just looked baffled. He had seen the often contentious relationship between the two sisters take many different turns over the years, but this was a new one on him. Nima looked terribly perturbed about something, out of all proportion to what Lakva had just done. All the calm, easygoing serenity she'd manifested on this visit, the payoff, he assumed, for the diligent study and discipline she'd undertaken to earn her master airbender's arrow so young, had deserted her with her elder sister's precipitous act, and she found herself hovering on the brink of blind panic. He couldn't let that go on if he could help it. "Hey," he said, his voice gentle. "What's the matter? You look like she just trapped you in a cave with a wild animal."
I,
Nima stammered, her face going even redder. "Come on," said Corwin, holding out an open hand. "It's just me. I'm not going to bite you." He grinned wryly,
whatever it is, it can't be that bad.
Nima hesitated, her continued impulse to flee warring with her innately honest, trusting heart. She took a slow step toward him, then another. Then she paused again and just looked at him, one fist pressed against her lips to stop them trembling. She stayed that way for a few seconds, breathing deeply, visibly getting herself under control. Then, in a tiny, brittle voice, she said,
"I love you."
Corwin looked back at her, his ice blue eyes widening slightly, not with alarm or even particular surprise, but a vast and warm compassion. He didn't flinch from the intensity in her eyes, nor the raw and aching vulnerability of her, didn't recoil from her declaration or seek to distance himself from it, physically or verbally. Instead, with a warm, slightly sad smile, he opened his hands and said softly, "Aw, Nima, come here." She went to his arms, not embracing him in turn, but putting her hands against his broad chest and resting her head between them instead. The wool of his sweater was soft on her cheek and smelled faintly of cedar. Now that she'd made a start at confessing, the rest of it spilled out of her in a low, husky murmur, the words almost jumbling together as they rushed to escape.
"I've had a crush on you since I was 10, but then you were gone for 6 years, and now you're back, and you have a child, and you're married, and I'm supposed to be a master air nomad, and I should be able to move beyond all that kind of thing, but I just can't. I'm so sorry."
"Hey, no, shh," said Corwin soothingly, enclosing her in his powerful arms. "You don't have anything to be sorry about." Nima's eyes were moist as she raised her head, when not ducking against his chest, she was nearly as tall as he, to look at him.
"Are you angry?" she asked.
"No, of course not," Corwin said. Then, downcast, he went on, "I'm a little sad, because..." He hesitated, then went on with regret in his voice. "Nothing I can say right now won't hurt you." Nima lowered her head, resting her cheek against his chest again. "It's all right," she said softly. "I wasn't expecting. I wasn't even going to mention it." Corwin nodded, holding her a little tighter. "I know, but it still makes me sad. I don't like hurting people I care about. And I do care about you, Nima. I don't ever want you to doubt that. But I can't give you what you want." Nima nodded, her face still pressed to his chest, and asked without looking up, "Is it because I'm ugly?" "Stop that," Corwin said, levering her chin up so that she had to look at him. "You're not ugly, Nima. The only ugly thing about you is your belief that you are. You're sweet and kind and incredibly brave and honest. I mean, you could have run away just now, or you could have tried to bluff your way out, but you didn't. No one can ever take any of those things away from you." Corwin saw a shadow cross her eyes then, and couldn't help but smile wryly. "I know, you're thinking, well, if he thinks I'm so great, then why..." She reddened slightly and ducked her head again. "I don't know," he said. "Not even the gods know how these feelings work, only that they are what they are." He lowered his own head onto her shoulder, squeezing her in her arms again, and said quietly, "So, I'm sorry." He kissed the top of her head, prickly fuzz and all, and added in a near whisper, "I hate to let you down." Nima made a sound that was half laugh and half sniffle, then said quietly into his sweater, "You're not letting me down. I let myself down. Some master airbender I am.
We're supposed to be able to let go of earthly attachments, and here I am.
She let out a faint whimper.
Great-grandmother would be so disappointed in me.
Jinora was 16 once, Corwin said. Airbending master or not, she knows you're not a machine. With a faint, wry chuckle, he added,
Where do you think your grandfather came from?
Nima giggled in spite of herself, then raised her red-rimmed eyes to his again.
Even now you can make me laugh, she said.
Well, I'm glad I can help a little bit anyway, said Corwin. I'm sorry it couldn't be more. If it's any consolation, I do love you, Nima. Just not the way you were hoping.
He paused, then grumbled self-critically. That was less lame in my head.
Nima sniffle-giggled again. Then she did put her arms around him in turn, burying her face deeper in his sweatered chest, and said in a muffled voice,
I'll take it.
He was visibly out of sorts when he returned, later than expected, to the sun parlor of Tenzin the Elder's house. Both Utena and Anthy noticed it. With a shared glance, they decided between them who would raise it, and it was Utena who beckoned him to settle on the futon between them, then asked him softly,
What's the matter?
Corwin gave her a thoughtful, slightly mournful look, considering his reply carefully, and then said,
I just had to break one of the kindest, gentlest, most loving hearts I know.
Ah, said Anthy with an understanding nod.
Nima.
You knew? Corwin wondered.
Everybody knows, Anthy replied. I'm surprised she broached the subject, though. It isn't like her to do something she knows will cause a disruption. However much healthier for her, it's likely to be that she's pulled off the scab.
Lakpa sort of forced her hand, said Corwin ruefully, and he explained what had just happened in the library.
Huh. Classy, Utena grunted, frowning. Someone needs to teach that girl a lesson or two.
I intend to let her know as soon as I see her that I don't appreciate the way she treats her sister, Corwin said, nodding. I mean, they've always had kind of an adversarial relationship, but what she just did was beyond the pale. There's no excuse for treating someone like that.
He sighed.
Nima's 3 years younger than Lakpa, Nal, and me, so I can't remember when she was born, but I do remember her as a toddler, then a little girl. Lakpa, and Nal, too, sometimes, used to consider her kind of a nuisance, the tag-along little sister. Me, I never saw her that way. She's always been interesting.
He lay back against the upright part of the futon and stretched out his arms along the back, one behind Anthy, the other behind Utena, and sighed.
When I was 11 and she was 8, and Lakpa was out chasing Nal around, Nima taught me the ancient airbender's language, Sherba. It's nearly a dead language nowadays, but she wanted to read to me from the writings of Gyatso the Wise, Avatar Aang's mentor, and she didn't want anything to be lost in translation.
He smiled slightly at the memory. That's the kind of mind she has.
Huh, wow, said Utena, nestling into the crook of his arm.
How long did that take?
3 weeks, Corwin said. When she glanced at him in surprise, he shrugged a little sheepishly and said, I'm good with languages. Get it from Dad. It's a Dedian thing.
Well, said Anthy after a few moments' thought, I hope you were gentle with her. Assuming, of course, you don't reciprocate her feelings.
I was, Corwin assured her. And I don't,
Well, I do and I don't. I mean, I do love her, and I don't mind saying so to you or her or anybody. She's an old friend and a genuinely beautiful soul. But I'm not in love with her. He sighed. Philos, but no Eros. Standard needs more words. Anthea agreed. They lay together, lost in thought, for perhaps half an hour, during which time the last of the sunset filled the room with red light and ever longer shadows from the west. Nobody bothered getting up to turn on any lights until it was almost fully night, and then only because Annabelle required routine maintenance that could not readily be accomplished in the dark. That homely task seemed to return them all from their respective reveries, though, and, with Annabelle fed, changed, and awake for the moment, the revitalized trio and their offspring and dragon turned happily to piling up some of what used, in Corwin's father's youth, to be called quality time. A while later, Utina had to retire to the smallest room by herself for a time. When she emerged and headed back toward the sun parlor, she discovered that the hall offered an excellent vantage point on the daybed well before the threshold. From this angle, Garnet was hidden in the covers somewhere, but everyone else was perfectly visible. Utina paused about halfway along the corridor and leaned against the wall, arms folded, and quietly watched with a fond smile while Corwin and Anthy played with their infant daughter. They were such a perfect little picture, the three of them. Mother, father, child. She hadn't anticipated how right they would all look together. And just like that, the feeling from last night was back. Suddenly, without warning, she felt like a voyeur, possibly even an intruder. And she knew that walking back into that room in this condition would be both unfair to them and possibly unbearable to herself. They would sense her disquiet. They would ask her about it, all in loving concern. And how could she ever admit to them, these people she had sworn never to lie to or hide things from, that she abruptly felt like an outsider in her own family? Silently, she took herself away. From the parlor, the scene, the house itself. She had to get out, get some air. Try to figure out what she was feeling, and what in all the world she could do about it.